I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
Thanks for joining us for the third interview in the podcast. This rabbi is a Reform rabbi, Eli Hersher. When we met, he was the senior rabbi at Stephen S. Weiss Temple in Los Angeles. Today, he is the senior rabbi emeritus at Stephen S. Weiss. And whatever your preconceived notions of Reform rabbis might be, I think he's going to surprise you.
I'm Eli Hersher. I have been a rabbi at Stephen S. Weiss Temple in Los Angeles for about 29 years, having come right out of rabbinical studies to the synagogue, served here for many years as the assistant and associate rabbi, and then about 6 or 7 years ago became the senior rabbi of the congregation. I guess we all have our Jewish stories and our journeys. Mine began in Israel in 1947, having been born to two parents who fled Germany in 1935, not knowing each other in Germany, came to Israel, met each other there, and were married in the nascent state. My parents lived there for 19 years, which brings us to 1954. When I was 6 and a half, and they made a decision to come to the States, where my father had a brother and a sister, and this was during a time when economically things were really very, very bad in Israel. And my father was concerned that, having been denied an education because of what was going on in Europe in the 30s, that he wanted to be certain that my brother and I would be able to get an education, and felt that he'd never be able to afford one, actually, in Israel at the time. In those early 50s, a high school education was not free. And made that decision to join family. We came to California, where family had settled in San Jose, which had a small but very nice and welcoming Jewish community. And that's where I grew up, in a Reform congregation in San Jose, California. My father had come from a modern Orthodox family in Germany. My mother from a fairly assimilated German-Jewish home. In Israel, I'd say they were both, and this was not unusual in those years, nor is it unusual today, they were probably more secular than anything else, observed all of the holidays, Pesach Seders, etc., but were not synagogue-attending Jews. And that changed when we came to the States, because there was more of a need. And I think that Israelis coming to the States today still experience this, that there was more of a need to identify with a community. In Israel, Israel was the community. Here you needed to find a Jewish community. And they did that, and that's where my brother and I grew up. Left there for Berkeley in the late 60s as an undergraduate in English. While I was there, found myself taking a lot of Hebrew and whatever Jewish studies classes were available, knowing that while I loved studying English and American literature, that there was another literature that was more deeply mine as a Jew, and I knew I wanted to learn it. And having had the beginnings of that as an undergraduate, the one way at the time that you got an in-depth Jewish education, about the only way, was rabbinical school. I wasn't entirely certain yet that I wanted to be a rabbi. And I remember I was honest about this in my interview with the Hebrew Union College. I don't know if they'd accept me today. because at the time I said I wasn't sure I wanted to be a rabbi, but I wanted to know what rabbis knew, and learn what rabbis learned. And 1970-71 was when I entered the rabbinical program. That was the first year of a mandatory year of study in Jerusalem, which was the first time that I was going back since I'd left as a child. It was an incredibly powerful year for me. Just emotionally, I felt a deep sense of belonging. Felt wonderful to be with the Jewish people in Israel. The studying was great. My Hebrew got really good. Came back to California, ready to enter the rabbinical school here in Los Angeles, and was asked if I would do high holiday services for a congregation of 30 families in San Luis Obispo, which it was too small at the time to have a full-time rabbi. Would I serve there as a student just for high holidays? I protested, saying I had no idea how to lead services. They don't teach you that in the first year of rabbinical school. They insisted that I go. I was young enough that they could intimidate me, and I went, and it was an incredible experience. Just to be able to stand before the congregation, to teach, to lead services, and to come to know the community. And following that, they'd asked if I'd come back twice a month. And I did for 3 years, which essentially it meant studying during the weeks here in Los Angeles and what I considered at the time playing rabbi on the weekends, that I got to go up there and try it on. And the response was very positive, and I knew that this was going to be more than my learning of texts, that it would, it was sufficiently compelling for me and rewarding in lots of ways, that was when I really decided I wanted to be a rabbi. It was when I got to do it. My family was not shocked that I chose this, and one of the reasons they weren't shocked is because my brother, who's 6.5 years older, he had chosen it before me. He was an influence as well in terms of knowing what he was studying meant. That perked my interest, piqued my interest. They weren't shocked. I think when my brother had decided to become a rabbi, they were a little more shocked. My father had wanted to be an architect. Hitler made that impossible. The learning couldn't take place. So instead he became a cabinet maker, which had been his family's business. He had learned it from his parents. So my father had a very practical point of view about what you should know in your life to be able to make it. He said you should be able to do something with your hands, that whatever happened, if you could build something, if you could be a craftsman, there'd always be work. So I think my father's initial reaction to my brother was, God forbid something should happen, you know, how are you going to make a living as a rabbi? We each bring our stories, and my father's story was a story of two immigrations. And so that was his concern. By the time I had decided to be a rabbi, my parents weren't surprised or shocked. I think they were, by this time, they were pleased. And I know that ultimately they were very proud. It's not something they would have imagined either of their sons would do. But there was a deep pride for both of them. I had been at the congregation for a couple of years, having decided, I was single, and had decided that it would not be a good thing to ever date a member of the congregation until this one woman came along, and I made an exception, and she has been my wife for almost 25 years. So we met here, and she had joined the congregation actually as a single parent. And so I got my daughter Dawn as part of my temple compensation. And then we went on to have two more children, Adam and Sarah. And, you know, hard for me to know how they felt growing up with the rabbi as their father. I think generally it wasn't all that difficult for them. There are preachers' kids, whether they're rabbis or ministers, who grow up feeling that they're in the limelight too much and that too much is expected of them in terms of behavior. You're the rabbi's kid. You should know better than to goof around. My kids goofed around as much as they wanted, pretty much normal kids. And all three of them, while none has become or plans to become a rabbi, and that was not a dream that I had for them, they're all committed to Jewish life in one way or another, and in the process of figuring it out for themselves in terms of what meaning they'll make of it as they continue to grow. Stephen S. Wise Temple is a congregation of over 3,000 families. Probably the largest congregation in the country. And with school programs, full-time programs, starting with Mommy and Me and nursery school, all the way through a full-time elementary school, a day school, and now through middle and high school. It's the only congregation that has a high school associated with it in the country, I believe. And that's been a central part of its vision, that is the educational component. That is extremely exciting because the place is never empty. There's never an empty room. That's a challenge of the place because there's never an empty room. As large as it is, there's a shortage of space. And in a sense, that's a problem that every congregation should have, that the place is full all the time with Jews, living a Jewish life and learning. The focus of the synagogue, and we're just 40 years old this year, in 2004, and the focus of the congregation has always been, at least the core vision, has been around the kids, around providing a really fine Jewish and secular education, recognizing that when you've got kids all day, you can teach them a level of Hebrew and you can give them content that you're going to be hard-pressed to do when you have a supplementary school. That is, when kids are coming Tuesday afternoon and Thursday afternoon, and you don't find a lot of adult Jews who look back at their Hebrew school education with great fondness. And that's because it's understandable. It's the worst time of the day. They've been in school all day. It's more school. No kid is going to want more school. Teachers are part-time. Many of them have been teaching somewhere else all day. They're tired. We have a supplementary school, and it's very, very important to us. But we know that the potential of a day school is so much greater. And the high school, especially so. The kids in the high school, the students in the 11th and 12th grade, are studying Jewish material that I didn't begin to study until I was in rabbinical school. So I'll walk into their classrooms and I'll hear the conversations that they're having and how they're engaged in Torah. And I'm in awe of what they've got. And I can just begin to imagine who they'll be as adults and how, at least it's a dream, that hopefully what they've learned is going to inform who they are, of how they face their lives based on the knowledge and the experience they've gained of Judaism. Having said that, it's not enough. That is, adults need to be engaged in deeper ways as well. Not everyone comes to it in elementary school or at bar bat mitzvah or in high school. In fact, most, if they're going to come to an experience of a compelling and engaging Jewish life, they're going to come to it later. And so there's, I think, a significant void in the Jewish community that many are trying to fill, of a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, a lack of experience in worship that touches one deeply and kind of awakens a Jewish soul. It's why you've got so many Jewish Buddhists. And there's nothing wrong in that, but when Jews start looking at religious traditions other than their own to get spiritual fulfillment, then the Jewish community has missed the boat somewhere along the line. So my vision for a congregation really is what I see as a vision for Jewish life, for what I would consider to be a complete Jewish life. There's nothing new about this vision. It's been there as long as Judaism exists. But often what happens in the Jewish community is that we end up focusing on one area that for which we think there's greatest need. So that there is a need, there's a spiritual thirst, I think, not just among Americans generally. And I believe it's there among Jews. And often the synagogue isn't the address for many of those Jews. So one of the challenges from my perspective within this synagogue context is how do we make our worship services, how do we fill them with joy and reflection? How do we touch people's lives where they're living? I'll be honest with you, a few years ago we radically transformed our Erev Shabbat service. The honesty of this is that we transformed it when I looked at our cantor one day and I said, I'm not certain, if I weren't a rabbi of the congregation, that I'd come to services here. And if, as the rabbi of the congregation, I have deeper needs, then I think we got to work on creating them, because I doubted that they were all that different from Jews in the congregation. So we really transformed the service. It's almost entirely sung, and the music makes a great difference. There's not a sermon, there's a few minutes of teaching, a reflection on a prayer to help bring it to life. And there are younger people coming, and there are kids coming with their parents, and they're having an experience of depth and of joy in Shabbat, which is what it ought to be. So one element of Jewish life that's so deeply important is that worship have meaning, that it be compelling, that it be engaging. Worship by itself, though, my own spiritual experience, without seeing the other, is limited. And therefore, worship also needs to be translated into community. And I think people are thirsting for that as well. For a community in which people really know each other, and if someone is missing at services, who's there regularly, that the people who normally sit next to that person say, hey, so-and-so's been gone for a couple of weeks. We got a call. We got to find out. Rather than people who are sick having to call a synagogue and say, please tell the rabbi I'm not feeling well, it's the people will notice, not just the rabbi, but that you build a community. So one element is the worship, the spiritual experience. Another is a stronger sense of community. the nation we live in is strongly individualistic, and that's wonderful. It's meant great achievement on the part of individuals and part of what makes this country great. But for many, it's gone to such an extent that they don't know who is living next door and don't care all that much who is living next door. And clearly, from a Jewish perspective, you can't have a fullness of Jewish life without the other. I spoke about learning for kids. This tradition wasn't created for them alone. It was created for Jews who want to take their lives as Jews seriously and want the texts of the tradition to somehow, I believe, provide some guidance for them in their lives. So we're talking about textual material of 3,000 years that addresses every dimension of our lives, from the moment that we get up in the morning and notice that it's a new day and we take in that first breath of wakefulness and expressions of appreciation for that, for just the fact that I woke up this morning, to beginning a day like that, to how you put on your shoes, which to me symbolically means how you're going to walk in the world, and everything dealing with my relationships with my wife, my children, my co-workers, the political realm. All of that is in Jewish learning, and the excite for me to watch the excitement of people who just begin to study Torah and see it and begin to embody it and begin to own it, most importantly, to say, this is mine, this is my text, is incredibly powerful. As a rabbi, I continue to study. I've been studying for the last 3 years at the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, which brings Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform rabbis together for learning. It's the only place that really accomplishes that. It's entirely pluralistic, where we're not addressed as Reform or Conservative or Orthodox or Reconstructionist rabbis. We're addressed as children of Torah, who are all studying the same Torah. Learning also builds community. These different elements of the vision are not distinct, actually. They're threads that tie them all together. You study with someone, you get to know the other as well. You study with them, you become part of the worship community. Lots of doors into Jewish life. And then two other elements, one of them being social justice. That is, this is not just about my spiritual life. If my spiritual life doesn't demand anything of me, then it's a lovely personal experience, but it's not Jewish. That's why people who focus on any just one element of this vision for me are, the threads end up being having loose ends. If I study Torah and I encounter Abraham arguing with God about Sodom and Gomorrah, and God says, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because of its evil, but I should consult, I should let Abraham know, because I've made him my partner in this venture, and I can't accomplish it without my vision for the world without Abraham. And he wants Abraham to step forth and question God's justice. What about the righteous people there? That's a model of Jewish living, and therefore the question of social justice can't be separated out of Judaism. And lastly, though not last in order of importance, is Jewish peoplehood, specifically Israel, that I am part of something bigger than my spiritual life, than my congregation, than my Jewish community in Los Angeles, that if I'm going to live a full Jewish life, there is a Jewish people, and beyond that Jewish people, there is a world that we are supposed to help create in God's image. Israel is a deeply important component of my own Jewish life, not only because I was born there, No, definitely not only because I was born there, but because close to half the Jews in the world are living there, because it's a great experiment in how you create a kind of Jewish life that will in fact be living in the real world, the political realm, the realm of power, how you handle power, that kind of struggle. It's a place where a Jewish vision, I think, can be most deeply realized. And for those Jews who choose to be here and not there, the relationship can be enriching to both partners. Those five components of a Jewish life, and I could talk it, obviously, this is what I do, at great length about each of them. If we can have all five of those operating within a synagogue and beyond a synagogue, then I think a transformation is possible. Those five elements aren't there for most Jews. Most Jews don't learn. Most Jews don't worship today, or know how to relate to prayer, how to relate to God. We have concepts of God that are very concrete that come from our childhood, and we never get beyond them. We reject them often without any newer and deeper ideas, all of which are there within the tradition. That needs to be taught. These are all components for me of the meaning of a vibrant Jewish life. They all mean a lot to me personally and how I live my own, or try to live my own Jewish life. And I'm finding in the congregation that people resonate to it. That when you offer good learning, they're there despite the fact that they've got incredibly busy lives. People are building careers. They've got children to take care of. You give them something good that's worth their taking the time, which is precious, and they respond. When rabbis lament the fact that Jews aren't coming, the question that ought to be asked is not what's wrong with them, but what are we giving them when they do come that deepens them and uplifts them and challenges them and helps them see that this is life, that this tradition is life. When it comes to what's good in the rabbinate and what's not good in the rabbinate, for me personally, most of it's good. I love being a rabbi. I'm lucky to be in a congregation that resonates to the kinds of things I'm trying to bring here. It would be very difficult, painful, if that people weren't responsive. I'm in a place that I have very supportive lay leadership, so that's very fortunate. If rabbis complain about one major thing, I think it's when they want to lead in one direction and lay leadership is not quite ready to see the vision. But I've been blessed not to have that kind of conflict. So I love to teach. I love leading worship. I love the life cycle and celebrating it and helping people through the various moments. The hardest thing for me about being a rabbi is when there are tragic deaths of young people, which become personally very painful. But even there, there's an important role a rabbi can play with families. What don't I like? Every rabbi has got to do certain administrative things that you want to kind of, you know, find ways of pushing those off the desk. But they're important also to the life of a synagogue. A large congregation such as this means that in order to sustain the kinds of programs I'm talking about and the vision I want to achieve, you know, if you want to have great Torah, you're going to have great teachers teaching it. which means you've got to be able to support the teachers, the real world of synagogue life that has to do with raising the funds to make it possible. The rabbis in Pirkei Avot, the sayings of the fathers, note, Im ein kemach ein Torah, if there's no bread, there's no Torah. They're very realistic, that you can't just live up on the mountaintop. You got to have your feet planted firmly in the reality. And they also say, Im ein Torah ein kemach, if there's no Torah, there's not going to be bread, that both are true. That means a rabbi in this congregation is going to be involved in raising funds. But that becomes part of sharing a vision. And if you are excited about the vision and you get of Jewish life, and you get others excited about it, they want to help make it happen. So I can't even say that that's, aside from the pressures of it, that isn't a negative either. That too is a positive.
Thank you to Rabbi Hirscher. We have three more segments coming up with him. And thank you to you for listening. If you like what you hear, please follow us, subscribe, and tell your friends. Give us a review. That helps a lot. And remember, our sponsor is Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKH.com. Hazaka.com, Jewish games that feed the brain. Thanks for listening.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.